Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
You gotta understand something here. This music is the glue of the world. It holds it all together. Without this, life would be meaningless.
So crazy about. It's just music.
30 years ago this month, Slayer came on the scene with its debut album, Show No Mercy, and metal hasn't been the same since. I'm Greg Cott of the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis from WBEZ and Columbia College. We talk to members of the pioneering metal band Slayer and review a surprising new collaboration from Billy Joe Armstrong of Green Day and Norah Jones. That's all coming up on Sound Opinions. This is Sound Opinions, and as far as we're concerned, no band in rock history says Christmas quite like Slayer.
You know, I was thinking the same thing, Jim. I mean, what other band? They ended one tour, which I heard about from the early 90s, where they were drenched in blood. You know, what says Christmas
show, right?
Like that, right?
Yeah, that's a holiday feast. We're going to have some fun talking about one of the most influential bands in the history of heavy metal. But first, some music news. Greg, that is a song called XO from the new self-titled Beyoncé album. And let me tell you, in the history of great endeavors in the Western world, there was that business of the Allies crossing the channel on D-Day in 1944, and then there is the surprise middle-of-the-night release of album number 5 from Beyoncé, her solo record. The big news was that as the clock struck 12 from Thursday to Friday, December 13th, Beyoncé, with no fanfare whatsoever, released this album via the iTunes store, and it has been selling gangbusters. By Sunday night, it had sold 617,000 copies only via iTunes with no pre-release publicity, with her having kept it well under wraps that she was even making this album, much less that she'd finished it, and social media kind of carrying the news to the world that this album is out. And she could not have bought the sort of publicity that she wound up getting for this release in its wake, but it's not without offending some people. Like, remember the good old brick-and-mortar mom-and-pop record stores? Some small independent retailers are saying, "We're not going to sell the album. If she only wanted to release it via iTunes, not give us a chance to sell the physical product." And also some big chains. Target is angry at her and is saying it will not stock the Beyoncé record if she's going to cut its customers out of the ability to buy the record and only sell it through iTunes. So this is obviously a big story, even without talking about the music. But you at home probably want to know if this is worth your time listening to Queen Bee's latest. Here's a song. It's called Pretty Hurts by Beyoncé on Sound Opinions. We'll come back and give our thoughts on the record.
Mama said, "You're a pretty girl. What's in your head? It doesn't matter. Brush your hair. Fix your teeth. What you wear is all that matters.
That is Beyoncé from her new self-titled album, a song called Pretty Hurts. It's the self-empowerment song that kicks off the record. You know, I was very skeptical about what this record was going to be because she had apparently had a false start with this record over the spring and summer, basically announcing that the album had been scrapped. She was starting over. And it is a more adventurous record. It is the record in some ways that she promised in 2011 when she said she was going to take more musical chances and didn't really. On this record, she is taking more musical chances. The expanse of the music, the kind of genres and range that she's displaying both musically and as a singer is the most impressive of her solo career. I'm not particularly impressed, though, by the lyrical content. There's always been this quality about Beyoncé where I felt she's a little wooden, a little plastic, a little removed from the rest of us, you know. Yes. When people think about a great singer, they talk about a person channeling emotions, and I've never really felt that from Beyoncé, and I'm not getting it on this album either. There's a couple of songs here where she is talking about feminism and about female empowerment, and those are impressive moments, but I think the lyrical ambitions do not match the musical ones. At the same time, I think it's musically it's one of the best things that she's done, so I'm going to give it a burn it rating.
I agree with your burn it, Greg. She was going, I think, for that sort of stripped-down soul R&B sound that is ruling the underground right now. But she's still working with, you know, high-profile collaborators, Missy Elliott, Big Boy, right? This weird juxtaposition in the lyrics between championing feminism. Flawless has that writer Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie giving that voiceover, right, about self-empowerment.
We teach girls that they cannot be sexual beings in the way that boys are. Feminist, a person who believes in the social, political, and economic equality of the sexes.
And then there's other lyrics, you know, Beyoncé's telling us how she likes to cook for her husband naked around the apartment, which is not to say that you can't be a mother and a wife and a feminist. It's just that she kind of puts different roles on in different songs, and you never, like you said, where is the real Beyoncé? Who is this woman? But it's something to hear. If you want to hear what the most expensive top dollar dance pop soul R&B can sound like today, it's worth giving it a spin. So a burn it, a double burn it from the two of us.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that's Show No Mercy, the title track from the debut record by Slayer. It was released 30 years ago this month, setting off a sound that would become the blueprint for speed metal. Lead singer Tom Araya, guitarist Jeff Hanneman and Kerry King, and drummer Dave Lombardo also racked up a bit of controversy over the years, and that's putting it mildly. Slayer's look and imagery, which references demons and violence, sometimes that overshadowed their evident musical virtuosity. Now, many of you will remember the name Slayer simply because they were bandied about by the Parents Music Resource Center in the 80s, headed at the time by one Tipper Gore.
I really think, Greg, that the PMRC would have liked Slayer to return to the bowels of the underworld from which they allegedly sprang. But despite that, the band has been going strong now for more than three decades, not without changes. We reported the death earlier this year in May of guitarist Jeff Hanneman. And when we sat down with the group in 2010 for a conversation, we spoke to Kerry King and Dave Lombardo, the drummer, who is now out of the group again. Nevertheless, it's 30 years since that first album. We wanted to mark that anniversary, talk about this band, and the guitarist and drummer at the time stopped by when they were on tour supporting World Painted Blood. We got the chance to reflect on this career.
Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So, you guys are kids when you started this band in California.
Yes, we were.
And Kerry, was kind of you and Jeff Hanneman basically at the core of it, or how did that start exactly?
I would say I did fishing and
found everybody, but Dave actually found me. But, you know, playing with Jeff, playing with Dave, then bringing Jeff in to play with Dave, and then all of us going to play with Tom, you know, it's just kind of planets aligned, you know?
It all just fell together in an odd way.
And was there like a vision at that point? You know, what's this band going to sound like? What are we going to play like? Was there a sense of that, or was it just four guys getting together in a room and bashing something out?
Yeah, I'd say that.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, you were probably 16, because me and Jeff were 17.
Yep, I was.
You know, we just got together with people like the same music we liked, because we had no intention of making up new music. We had no idea how to approach it.
First gig at a high school? Your high school?
No.
No, our first gig was
at a park, Southgate Park Auditorium.
Battle of the Bands.
Battle of the Bands on Halloween.
Did you win?
I don't think so.
I don't think so, no.
I don't think we were any good.
Craig was alluding to whether the sound was there when you first came together or not. You guys have become so iconic as one of, you know, the defining bands of a whole subgenre of metal. What were the ingredients that went in? What was on everybody's turntable at that point?
I think Dave was probably the one that, and still today is the one that likes everything under the sun. At that point, I was probably really into Priest and Maiden, and Jeff had jumped off into hardcore West Coast, more West Coast than anything else, hardcore punk, and that's where the speed and aggression came from. Mm. And Dave liked everything, so it just worked.
Yeah, but the punk rock really fueled, I think, the heavy metal that we were into. You know, the Judas Priest style of riffing. You know, we brought that into, you know, that style of guitar riff.
Yeah.
Kind of blended those two together.
And the idea that there could be metal music that didn't have fat, the way that punk didn't have fat, right?
Well, metal had the intricate riffs, you know, and wasn't only singing about angst.
Right.
Punk was just based on a vibe, I think. Could have been three chords, could have been six chords, but it didn't really matter. It was just the vibe.
A lot of people talk about that early 80s thing as sort of the shift in sound. Well, you talk about the aggression coming from metal. But, you know, the speed, the thrash metal thing, you guys are considered some of the pioneers of that. Was that a conscious thing? We're going to play three times as fast as anybody else? I mean, we're talking about 220 BPM, I think, by the time you guys were making Rain and Blood.
I think that developed slowly as, remember, we were young. Adrenaline, testosterone, we were, you know, high on life. And with the combination of that and playing live, and it just sped up in a way to become comfortably fast and to a point where, hey, this feels good.
I was going to have the same story probably worded a little different. You know, Dave is, like, we bring stuff in and, you know, none of us are... Like, if I made it up or Jeff made it up, none of us really own it yet. You know, we're showing it to Dave, and it naturally progresses speed-wide for probably a couple weeks till it finds that place where we know this is where we got to stop. Mm. And I don't know how we know that, but we're talking about it last night because one of the songs in the shows was borderline right there. It's like, if it's any faster, I can't keep up. And we just ended there. That's where it was.
But were you conscious of, like, this is kind of like the new thing? Did you guys feel like you were doing something... kind of the next era.
For me, all I wanted to do was be the anti-LA. Mm. I wanted to be as far away from Poison and Rat as you can possibly get. I think we did it.
And what was it about those bands that was turning you off that said, we don't want to be them?
I never understood why girls wanted to go see guys dressed like girls. I never got it. You know, to this day, I don't get it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't real to me.
And Dave, I'm looking at your T-shirt. You got a Gene Krupa T-shirt on there. It's pretty cool. And you are the guy, a lot of people say, you know, man, the double kick drum, that was like huge innovation. When did you start toying with the elements of here's what I'm going to play here, here's how I'm going to hit it, expanding the sound of metal in a lot of ways?
Well, as we were writing the songs early on, you know, of course they would give me the idea, hey, why don't you put double bass in this section? Mm-hmm. So I would have to find ways of developing patterns to, you know, bring that in to the riffing that they were bringing. So it's really natural and almost innocent how we did it. Because we really, I didn't take lessons. Mm-hmm. I was just listening to records and mimicking what was on the records. So it was just instinct and just experience of what I had listened to prior in my life or during that time, that I was just taking little bits of information and creating my own.
Listening to Gene Krupa and jazz at drummers
at that time? No. But sure, like, I was listening to Latin jazz at that time. I was really exposed to a lot of that through my brother-in-law, who was telling me, now this is real music. I go, no, dude, this stuff, you know, and I would play him some Judas Priest or Kiss or Iron Maiden.
Funny part of that story is Dave never wanted a second kick.
Oh, yeah?
Remember?
No.
He didn't want it. It's like, I don't need that second kick. I'm like, listen, man, it's going to be awesome. Yeah. And we kind of persuaded you into giving it a shot, and you loved it.
Parents should realize that we have explicit and graphic sex, extreme violence, suicide in lyrics that is going to children that are sometimes not even teenagers yet and young teenagers.
Well, let's talk about the way that you guys first probably broached the mainstream consciousness outside the metal community, outside the rock world, when this woman, Tipper Gore, starts attacking the content of the songs. And I mean, we were both starting our careers at that point or just beginning to write about it. I mean, it was just like, you don't understand this band. And yet there you are on television on Capitol Hill and other people jumping on the bandwagon. It's like, have you ever listened to this band? Do you know what these lyrics are about? Do you know what this band is about? You know, now that that's ancient history. How does it feel to have been demonized in such a way?
I remember when all that went down, and I said, the only thing this is going to do is make kids want it more. Yeah. And realistically, they did, you know, and if that kid wanted that record, he was going to get it. You know, I don't know if he had an older friend, an older brother, you know, they're going to get it. It's you're almost making it like the drug industry when you ban things, you know what I mean? It's like, somebody wants it, they're going to get it.
Kerry, I know you've got a kid, at least one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Put yourself in Tipper Gore's shoes for a minute. I know how, that sounds really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I don't think they fit.
Flip it around. If you were her and sort of dealing with, okay, there's controversial content, explicit words. There's stuff in here that may be inappropriate, quote unquote, for a young kid to be listening to. How would you have handled it differently than
well, then
she
be
did
a parent and take responsibility for your offspring.
Mm-hmm.
Don't blame me for something you can't control.
Period.
That's it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right.
Sorry, yeah. I'm a realist.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Your kid comes across some Two Live Crew record or something like that. You say, hey, that's okay to listen to, but here's some things you need to know, or how do you handle a situation like that?
I think a lot of people don't give kids enough credit. Mm-hmm. You know, 90-95% of them understand it's entertainment, you know, and I'm not sitting here after I leave the studio going to go have a beer with Satan at the corner bar, you know what I mean?
Right.
Coming up on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX, we'll have more of our conversation with Kerry King and Dave Lombardo of Slayer. Then Greg and I will get to some album reviews, including the latest from community star Donald Glover as Childish Gambino.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Greg Kot with Jim DeRogatis, and you're listening to our conversation with Kerry King and Dave Lombardo, the founding guitarist and drummer from the heavy metal band Slayer. Their debut, Show No Mercy, was released 30 years ago this month, but Slayer was still a relatively underground band in California until the 1986 release Rain in Blood. You're hearing the title track from that album now, which was produced by the then-fledgling hip-hop mogul Rick Rubin. So I asked Dave Lombardo what it was like to work with someone from such a different music arena. You got together with Rubin. He signs you to a hip-hop label, Def Jam. Were you guys a little weirded out by the whole idea of being approached by a guy who was essentially running a hip-hop label at that time? Did you see any connection between what you guys were doing and what was happening in New York City hip-hop with Public Enemy and the Beastie Boys at that time?
I think at the time, just being out of what we were in and going into a major label scenario was good for us. And somebody that was cutting edge, like Rick Rubin, I think boosted us and helped us and put us in a different category of musicians, where this guy, Rick Rubin, you know, took notice, hey, there's something special about this band that I don't see anywhere else. And I think it was a great move on our part.
Well, obviously, you made a classic record with him, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
In, your third record, Rain in Blood. Kerry, what was the big difference for you in working with Rubin between what Slayer was and what it became with that record?
Well, the obvious one's budget.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't even care about that. We still wanted to go in and work, you know, till the sun came up. That was just who we were. And, you know, we've been asked a million times, did you know these 10 songs were, you know, historically going to be referred to as one of the greatest thrash metal albums of all times? And no, they were the next 10. Mm-hmm. You know, we just went in and did them. Mm-hmm. And Rick made us realize we didn't need the reverb, like the Venom sound, so to speak. And when he took all that reverb out and cleaned it up, man, it was just brutal. It just punches you in the forehead from top to bottom.
I think it also kind of showed people that you guys could really play. At that point, it was kind of like, wow, these guys are really good at what they're doing. You can make all these comments about the lyrics, but there was no doubt that there was sort of a level of musicianship on that record.
Let me make a note also that that was before computers. Mm-hmm. That was before recording digitally. That was all on tape.
But was the band always playing together at the same time, Dave?
Yes.
So not even slicing with a razor blade or...
I mean,
there was times
maybe,
that happened.
Yes.
But it's not like with Pro Tools where you're mixing and matching verses.
No. And that's abuse to music.
But it's so easy.
It is.
I love it.
It makes our life easy. But,
yeah. And it's interesting, too, you talk about the 28-minute record, because at the time, a lot of the iconic metal records at the time were getting longer. You know, Metallica was making these 8, 9, 10-minute tracks, and you guys are going in the exact opposite direction. Yeah. Was it almost like you were listening? Were you listening at all to what everybody else was doing and kind of saying, we're going to go in the exact opposite direction? Or
No, we just did what we wanted to do, regardless of what was happening. You know, I can't remember when Puppets came out in regards to Rain and Blood. I know they were really close, but, you know, that was a real good time for music, because that's my favorite Metallica record, Master of Puppets, and most fans' favorite Slayer albums, Rain and Blood, so something was going on that year.
And then you guys went exact opposite direction yet again, you know, with the next record. You know, you follow up one of the fastest, hardest hitting records ever, and then you just completely hit the brakes with the next record.
Was that a, again, like, we're not going to repeat ourselves, we're going to go somewhere else with this record?
That one was definitely thought about because, you know, putting the set list together, it was just brutality. It was just blasting people in the face, you know, and there's no dynamic to the performance. So mm-hmm. we're like, all right, we just did this, South of Heaven, let's, you know, concentrate on being heavy. So we had something to offset, you know, all the Rain and Blood and Hell Awaits stuff.
And it was an interesting move because you would become popular. I think Rain and Blood ended up selling like a half mil. Huge success considering that you guys are essentially an underground band. And then South of Heaven, you basically go away from the sound that made you popular, which was kind of a perverse move at the time. I mean, were any of you saying, I don't know, maybe we should just do more of the same. You know, we got popular doing this.
When you're in a band, I mean, you always need to evolve. You need to try new things. Let's say if we tried to repeat Rain and Blood, you can't really try to top yourself. You have to try to experiment and see if that's the way to go. So I think it's great, the direction that the band went at that time, because like he says, it brings diversity to the set. And, you know, there's a lot groovier stuff. Mm. And then again, it shows our musicianship, too, that we can play slow. It's not just a bunch of noise. Come on.
Doing that record, it made me realize that we left something behind on Rain and Blood that we had to go back and make sure we got to take with us. So I think Tom sang way too clean on that record because I like the intenseness of the Rain and Blood album. And even though there's great songs on South of Heaven, I don't like it as much because of the vocal performance. So I knew in doing Seasons in the Abyss that we had to blend those and make the happy medium of sorts.
Welcome to my world, involve yourself within my dream. Just like your mind thought not to be. Take a look through time and past all present worlds to be. I rule this inferno, it's the for eternity.
1990 record Seasons in the Abyss was kind of like the fifth album. That seemed to be like kind of a summing up of where you guys were at that point. It seemed like all the great stuff that, in fact, you're playing it on this tour.
Yeah.
It seems to be one of those albums that, okay, you want everything that's good about Slayer. It's all on this record. Did you feel that way when you were making it? That was kind of that kind of a statement?
I think for me, we were taking all the good parts of the past and making a record out of it.
Yeah.
You hear that most, again, on the new one, World Painted Blood. I think it's everything anybody could like Slayer for, and it's all on that record. So it's just kind of set us up for what we were going to be, I think,
mm-hmm.
what we thought we were going to be.
We're talking to Kerry King and Dave Lombardo of Slayer. For all the talk about the shock value of the lyrics, there's an artistry there. There's a poetry, not to get overly heavy. I mean, did that ever bother you guys? I mean, there's a lot of thought there. There's a lot of intellectual thought. There's three of you are writing the lyrics at different points, right? And does that ever tick you off? People say that all we are is shock, and yet there is this content there?
Well, I mean, realistically, you can't write those kind of things without being intelligent enough to back them up. Look at our writings, look at Marilyn Manson's writing, anybody that writes, you know, not straight down the road stuff. Yeah, I look back to Angel of Death and Disciple, you know, different eras, but the same kind of thing. And Jihad, for instance, you know, if somebody took those lyrics and made a documentary out of it, and it was on Discovery Channel, it'd win awards. But yeah. Slayer wrote it, so it's dangerous.
There has been this increasing political bent over the last couple of records, putting the death, destruction, blood, and mayhem in the context of, hey, look around. there's death, destruction, blood, and mayhem everywhere. Talk about rain and blood. It's been less storytelling and more kind of repertorial.
You know, the funny thing is, Disciple came out on God Hates Us All, which everybody knows came out on September 11th. Then you look at Disciple, and it looks like I knew something. I just, you know, watch the news and take little snippets and make a song out of it, and it actually turned into reality almost exactly.
Die for peace with acts of war, the beauty of death we all adore. I have no faith, distracted me. I know why your prayers will never be answered. God hates us all. God hates us all. God hates us all. God hates us all.
One of the things that I find incredibly inspiring at a Slayer show is the sense of community. If you say you're a Slayer fan, it still means something. You're part of a community. You're part of an aesthetic. Is that a heavy responsibility? Is that something you guys ever think about?
I know what you're saying, but I think just being who we are, making up the songs we make up, doing these kind of interviews, doing in stores, you know, you're giving back and you're seeing who's coming. You know, it's still the original guys and their kids and their grandkids and older brothers and younger brothers and, you know, sisters now too. I mean, the amount of women coming to the shows is just staggering, especially the ones in the pits that are thrown with the guys. That's impressive.
Yeah, you see it in the front row.
Yeah.
See the poor girls there all squished among these guys. You know, what did I get myself into?
What's interesting, I wanted to follow up on what Jim was saying, though, because I think it's an excellent point. These last couple of records have been as intense as anything you guys have ever done. In fact, I think there's almost been kind of a rebirth in the band, it feels like to me. Like, the music is every bit as good as it ever was. And if it's possible, it seemed like when you were younger, you guys were maybe playing around with some of the shock tactics and sort of playing around with, yeah, okay, we are kind of edgy. You know, you think that was satanic? Well, we'll give you a satanic song, you know, almost playing with it. Now, it seems like if it's possible, you guys are angrier than ever at what you're seeing in the world.
We're really good at being angry now.
Yeah. Well, it's weird. It's like you think, oh, you know, a little bit older, they're going to lose a little edge. It seems, no, you guys are more ticked off now. It seems like it's got a more of a serious edge to it in some ways.
I know what you're talking about. I can see it in things I've written. I guess I'd attribute that to being older and seeing things differently, you know. Certainly doesn't mean I can't be upset about what's going on, but I like to invoke thought. I like people to, you know, if you get anything out of something I read, I don't care if you believe anything I say, but if it makes you think about something and question something that you've never questioned before, then I've done my job.
What about the reaction of the fans? What kind of feedback do you guys get? Because there has been the myth about the band that the fans are actually scarier than the band.
Yeah, I had a weird story in Spain once I've told a million times, but we were out signing after the show, you know, they had them all line up somewhere outside, and you know, I'm rolling down the line with my pen, signing some stuff, and this guy hands me what I assume is a Sharpie, and I'm like, no, dude, I got my own, I'm good, and, you know, he doesn't understand a word I'm saying, but, you know, he's grunting at me with his, and I'm like, oh, he must have the special pen, so I grabbed his pen, and hands me a scalpel, wants me to carve Slayer or something into him. I'm like, man, I'll sign anything you got, but I'm not going to cut you, you know?
Yeah, wow.
But he was intense, man. He wanted it. He saw, you know, some of the imagery on our albums and stuff, and he decided it was his time.
Yeah, their enthusiasm is a little scary. They're really nervous. Mm. Their hands are really sweaty, and, you know, they're shaking. Mm-hmm. You think, man, this guy's nuts.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
You know, they're just happy to see you.
Yeah, they say that. That's it. Sure are. Thanks for coming out.
Now, go get a napkin, will you? Dry your hands.
This summer, you guys toured stadiums in Europe with the Big Four. It was you, Megadeth, Metallica, Anthrax. And there has been an aspect of it. There's the infighting between the bands and all this. How much of that is myth? How much reality? Was it good to sort of be on the stage with those three other bands?
It's all true. We all hate each other. We've been fighting for the past 20-some years.
I have.
Yeah. I'm starting to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it goes back, though, and actually I was talking to Dave Mustaine about this a few days ago. Like, to my mind, it reminds me of any great period in music, there's always a little bit of competition, or maybe a lot of competition, between the best bands of the day, and they make each other better through that. And I think it's been true of almost every year in rock history. Did you feel that was the case when you guys were basically all coming up together in the 80s?
I think in the back of our minds, you know, we might have thought, you know, you'd hear a record and go, I can make up something better than that. But that's about the end of it, you know? I mean, I truly didn't like some of these guys. I didn't talk to Mustaine for like 20 years. Mm-hmm. Not even a word. It's like, I ain't talking to him. But, mm-hmm. you know, this tour came up, and before we even, you know, touch base with each other, I'm like, I would be a douche if I didn't let this tour happen for the fans. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was my first, you know, first thought. You know, the fans deserve this. So I got in touch with him on, I think it was on the way to the Australian gigs. And I said that to him. I walked up and I said, hey, dude, I don't think I spoke to you in 20 years. Mm-hmm. You know, and he's said through the press a million times, you know, I don't want to repair a friendship. I want to start a new one. And I'm like, all right, well, we'll see where it goes.
And what happened?
We're still seeing where it goes.
But playing together. Yeah.
Well, it seems like the band is, in a lot of ways, as I said, making music as good as it ever has. But Tom has had some medical issues. He's also given some interviews where he's talked about, you know, he sees a sort of a finite period here for the band. I mean, where are you guys at right now in terms of that?
It's taken me, I was going to say this when you were talking about Dave playing a minute ago, sometime on this album cycle, you know, I turned around and looked at Dave one night and I'm like, this guy's going to be like Dio of drums. He's going to be on that drum stool when he dies. You know, I don't see Dave ever stopping.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was refreshing because I'm like, all right, I got somebody to play with now. Cool. But yeah, I don't know what Tom's talking about. You know, if he feels like that, he hasn't discussed it with us. It could be, I haven't read the interviews, so I don't know if it's coming for him, if the words are getting twisted. I don't really know.
It's coming to me in different angles, too.
Do you feel creatively right now that the band is at a kind of a different level?
Yes. We work much, so well. We work so well together now. You know, in the studio, writing, and on tour.
Dave, this is like your third stint. You've been a lifer in this band, in and out at various stages.
Yeah.
Of those three stints, which one has been the most enjoyable from your standpoint? And what's the difference? Why is it different now than
older and wiser?
Yeah,
it's like, hey, here I am. I was put onto this world, and here I am playing drums and playing in a band, going on tour. How can things be? You know, why should I complain?
Kerry King, Dave Lombardo of Slayer, it's been an honor and a pleasure having you guys on Sound Opinions. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks, boys.
Thanks, man. Very cool.
To sound off on Slayer or anything we talk about on Sound Opinions, call 888-859-1800. Next up, Greg and I review new albums from Norah Jones and Billy Joe Armstrong and Childish Gambino. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX. Don't give the mess, I'll live my fate, I'll get no amnesty. I can't control my destiny, there is no way to leave. I'll play my death with my wrath, I take full out stride. If down to ineffective course, I will never die. You think by killing me tonight, my powers will not rise. There'll be no way for you to rise when hatred comes to light. Condemned to feel a prophecy, a lie, no first born. Divide them over declaration, leave you ripped and torn.
Welcome back to Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot, and that is a tune called Roving Gambler that kicks off an album called Foreverly, coming to us from Billy Joe Armstrong and Norah Jones. Greg, people will know, Billy Joe Armstrong is the leader of Green Day, came out of the Berkeley underground punk rock scene, became a post-Nirvana alternative era superseller, stars, evolved into a very ambitious band, recording things like American Idiot, a concept album that would eventually get turned into a Broadway
play. As a daughter of the sitar master Ravi Shankar, Nora Jones started out singing in coffee houses in Greenwich Village, was signed to the prestigious Blue Note jazz label, worked with the great Arif Martin, who had produced Aretha Franklin, and really made a splash with her first two albums in the early 2000s. These two things, unlike peanut butter and chocolate, would not seem to go together, Billie Joe Armstrong and Nora Jones, much less on a concept project wherein they not only cover the Everly Brothers, the pre-rock and roll masters of harmony singing, right, but they're remaking in particular an entire album that the Everlys recorded, Songs Our Daddy Taught Us, in 1958. This record was initially recorded and released. It was a fairly obscure record. This is not like Everly's greatest hits. This is a record that flew under the radar, that was a collection of folk standards, none of which the Everly brothers wrote, right? So it's folk songs covered by the Everlys being remade by a punk rocker and a new age jazz chanteuse in 2014. I'm sorry if you got confused there. It's all a little confusing. Let's just play a song. Here is Oh So Many Years by Billie Joe Armstrong and Nora Jones from the For Everly album. We'll come back and give our opinions on Sound Opinions.
All these many years I've loved you, no one has ever known, no one has ever known but you alone. I've kept it locked inside my heart and smiled through all my tears, my darling.
Oh, So Many Years from the new collaboration by Billie Joe Armstrong and Nora Jones called For Everly, named after the Everly Brothers and their 1958 album Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. Billie's doing Don's parts and Nora's doing the high fill harmonies on this particular album. Didn't expect this coming, you know? I have to say, what are these two going to do together? I didn't expect them to pick out a 1958 Everly Brothers album to cover front to back.
See, I thought this had been on your Christmas wish list last year. I really wish Nora Jones and Billie Joe Armstrong would cover the Everlys.
The idea here was that these were songs that were taught to Phil and Don Everly by their father. Now Phil and Don are sort of passing them down a couple generations later, and Billy Joe and Nora are doing them. And that's kind of a cool idea. The one little twist is that obviously it's a female voice against the male voice, as opposed to the two original male voices singing these parts. And it does give a certain tension to some of the songs where relationships have gone wrong in Long Time Gone and Down in the Willow Garden. Or Nora taking the lead as she does on I'm Here to Get My Baby Out of Jail. You know, the mother coming to get her son out of the clink and lamenting the bad turn that his life has taken. But I'm thinking if two people other than two famous pop stars like Armstrong and Jones had done this album, would anyone care? And I'm coming down to the idea that not really. They don't really transform these songs in any significant way. I don't sense a lot of chemistry between these two. It seems to be sort of a marriage of convenience. Oh, I sort of know Norah Jones. I'm going to do an album with her. That's basically what Billy Joe Armstrong has said in a couple of interviews. I'm not sensing that they took these songs anywhere new. I think the one great value of this record is that it does point listeners back to the original Everly Brothers album, which was indisputably a great record. This is not. I'm going to have to give it a trash it.
No, it's not a great record. What's more, this is a silly, 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 silly record, Greg. It is clearly a marketing ploy. You know, let's put the jazz chanteuse with the pop punk guy. There are bigger problems than the fact that Norah Jones is a female singing the male part. You know, Billy Joe can't sing. You know, he's got a charmingly gruff voice, which is perfectly fine for pop punk. It is not suited for Everly Brothers harmonies. Given that the instrumentation is really spare, low-key drums, a little piano, a little bit of pedal steel, and it's all about the vocals, and the fact that the woman, you know, Norah can sing, but Billy Joe can, and even if he could, the voices aren't going together well, that it makes it an abject failure. And what's more, to go back to the Everly's original, which I did after listening to this, there's a certain creepy undertone to this record.
Yeah.
The number of songs about mom and being overly, now look, I love my mother. I know you love yours, okay? But there is like some creepy mom obsession on these tunes. You know, it's not my favorite Everly Brothers. Everybody needs one great best of Everly Brothers set. I don't think that this is a great Everly's album. It's certainly not great as reimagined by Armstrong and Jones. So I second your trash it.
Hold up, wait a minute, all good just a week ago. Crew at my house and we party every weekend. So on the radio, that's my favorite song. Make me bounce around like I don't know, like I won't be here long. Now the thrill is gone, got no patience, cause I'm not a doctor. Go, why is you lying? Girl, why you Mufasa? Yeah, mi casa su casa.
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and that is Childish Gambino with a track called 3005 from his new studio album, Because the Internet. Childish Gambino, otherwise known as Donald Glover, born in California, spent most of his childhood in Georgia. He's had a multifaceted career, better known early on as an actor, writer, comedian than a hip-hop recording artist. He was a writer on 30 Rock, that NBC comedy series, for a number of years. He played college student Troy Barnes in that NBC TV show Community. He's been a stand-up comic. He was a member of the sketch comedy group Derek Comedy that got a lot of notice on YouTube. And oh, by the way, he's also a rapper. He started his career in 2008 with an indie album called Sick Boy, followed it up with another release in 2009. In 2011, he was signed to Glassnote Records, which put out his Camp album in 2011. That put him on the map with a lot of the hip-hop blogs. And now we have the second studio album for Glassnote called Because the Internet. Here's a little bit of that album. It's called No Exit from Childish Gambino on Sound Opinions.
Can't sleep. 3 a.m. stare at the ceiling, murdered a feeling, spider crawling the corner, brown recluse. So appropriate. Cornucopia, so be it, say I'm over it. Playing little dirt, this ain't what you want. Look at my feet, I put my sneakers in the trunk. Pass a fat burger through Atwater Village, laugh for a minute, couldn't cry for the life of me. Park by the bridge, sit on the hood, look at the cars, stare at my hands, look at the moon. I can't find it, it's gone, what's wrong? Didn't respond when I texted you last night, you alright? Yeah. Bound to a body inside of me, 20 million degrees. Burn a man to his knees. Let it not be. Hurry, bought a McFlurry and half of an apple pie. When I'm laughing, I'm satisfied. When I'm dying, I'm still alive. Strange position. I'm in a good mood. So good, I'ma kill that spider. The kind of things that they told me alone don't mean that you're only alone means you finally get it. Maybe they go home, lock up the doors, pull out the clothes, watch some cartoons, turn off the lights. Look at the recluse. Look at the recluse. The recluse. Look at the recluse. Got the red.
say. Don't go, gotta know, please don't run away. I'm a murderer. What does that change?
That was No Exit from Childish Gambino's Because the Internet. And early on, I think a lot of people in the hip-hop world, as well as the indie rock world, were saying this is a guy who's a really good comedian, and he's fine on television when he's acting. He's dabbling in hip-hop. He's kind of doing it as a novelty, especially when he would do stuff like sample or incorporate parts of Sleigh Bells and Grizzly Bear songs, okay? But I think he came into his own on that last album, and I think he really takes a leap forward with Because the Internet. It's a concept record of sorts, mulling over the ways life is becoming stranger and stranger in this digital age. And he can reflect, Donald Glover, on some heavy things like this ability that we'll soon have to perhaps be printing guns in 3D on printers, right? But then he also has like a borscht belt comedian ability to throw out pretty silly lines. Every marriage is a same-sex marriage, same sex every day. It's like, wow, thank you, Henny Youngman. I think he is saved by the fact that, much like Chance the Rapper, whom he's collaborated with, he's not fronting. You know, he is a Hollywood guy, but he's not pretending to be somebody he's not. He's talking about sometimes some very serious things and sometimes some sublimely trivial things. He has a fondness for, like, referencing shows on the Disney Channel, okay? Mm. And sometimes he waxes politically incorrect. I have no use for his use of the B word. But he's a real guy, and you feel like you're hanging out with him. It's a fun ride, and I give it a buy it.
Jim, I wouldn't say it's a lot of fun. It does jump around a lot. I'll give Childish Gambino that. There's all these diverse musical settings. You know, you got a little bit of jazz saxophone in World Star. You got that rock guitar solo in The Worst Guys. You've got that acoustic guitar with that gothic atmosphere and shadows. I mean, he keeps jumping around. And I guess the topic here is the internet. So you have this sort of ADD-like attention span,
yeah,
where you're consuming bits and pieces of things here. But I feel like this album has been done 10 times already by different artists over the last decade. I mean, the internet has been around for a little while. There have been a lot of albums using it as sort of a metaphor. The references to hackers, hashtags, web slang throughout this record, I don't see that as being particularly innovative. I don't sense any kind of emotional investment from this artist in this material. It's kind of clever on the surface, but he's not telling me something we don't already know.
Yeah, but when he's singing about Oakland and the streets of Oakland and how, you know, I think he's talking about, you know, a real community versus this virtual community. I think there's emotion on
that's,
here.
That's a new idea. I mean, I'm sorry. I've heard that before done better by other artists.
He's not reinventing the wheel.
He sure isn't.
It was a fun ride. You didn't have any fun.
But I don't think it's fun. He's kind of gloomy and depressed in this record. He's talking about how, you know, he's a sad, lonely boy, you know, playing with his computer and nobody loves me and we're not connecting in the world.
But he's also goofing on Disney.
I've heard that before. I don't get any kind of emotional punch from this record at all. I think it's a waste of time. It's a trash it record for me.
A dramatic divergence of opinion. A trash it from Greg, a buy it from me for Childish Gambino. What do we have on the show next week, Greg?
Jim, the Christmas celebration continues Sound Opinion style. We're going to look at the dawn of heavy metal.
Sound Opinions is produced by Robin Lynn, Jason Saldana, Anthony Martinez, and our intern, Jake Smith.
Sweatspot Susan, won't you give me a line?
On Sound Opinions, everyone's a critic. So now it's time to hear what you have to say.
I need a doctor, give me 999.
New messages.
Hey, this is John Straw in Santa Ana, California. I'm calling. I just listened to your Best of 2013 show and was nice to see Chance the Rapper. My son at 14 is a huge hip-hop fan, and though we might agree on a few old-school rappers, most of the stuff he listens to I can't connect with, but when I heard you early in the year of Chance the Rapper and shared it with him, we both became big fans. Actually saw him a couple of weeks ago here in Santa Ana, California at a small club. And even though I was probably the oldest guy there and he was the youngest, we had a great time. And thanks so much for finding a rapper that we both can enjoy.
Yep.
I got the juice, I got
yep.
The juice. God, give me one sentence more.
Hey, Jim and Greg, this is Steven from Seattle, Washington. I just finished listening to your show on your favorite records of the year and absolutely love the Chance the Rapper album. Fantastic. I love the Savages album, And I also love the Parquet Courts album, and it would totally be my number one album of the year had it not come out in 2012. Other than that, the lists were great. Thanks.
Hi, Jim, Greg, and Andy. This is Aaron in Raleigh. Normally, I love your show, but your Christmas spectacular this year was terrible. I work in retail, and by the time Christmas finally rolls around, I am so tired of hearing the same songs for 9 hours a day. This year, it sounded like Andy just copied some places of Muzak. Managed to hold on through NRPQ, Cheap Trick, and Ramones, but by the time XTC's song came on, I just had to stop. I hope next year's show is better. Love you guys. Bye.
Steve Brummel, Austin, Texas. Hey, guys, in regard to your Christmas show, best Christmas songs ever, rock and roll, can't believe my favorite didn't make the list. The Pogues' Fairy Tale of New York, but thank you very much for the show.
The boys of the NYPD choir were singing going by, and the bells are ringing out for Christmas Day.
Hi, guys. Lorenzo from Portland, Maine. I just want to let you know I really loved the Christmas show, and I fully agree with Andy that the Kinks' Father Christmas is the best rock and roll Christmas song ever.
He said, Father Christmas, give us some money. Don't mess around with those silly toys. We will beat you up. Don't hand it over. We want your bread, so don't make us annoyed. Give all the toys.
Two you didn't mention. If you're going to be a two-hit wonder band, well, the Waitresses had I Know What Boys Like and Christmas Wrapping.
Bah, humbug, well, that's too strong, cause it is my favorite holiday. But all this year's been a busy blur. Don't think I have the energy to add to my already mad rush, just cause it's tis the season. The perfect gift for me would be completions and connections left from last year.
And I still get chills when I watch the Monkees episode where they do the Fenichia called Rio Chio. Villain Kiko, Rio Chio. Thanks. Love the show.
Rio, Rio, Chio, La Guarda Rivera. Dios guardó, Dios guardó el lobo de nuestra codera. Dios guardó, Dios guardó el lobo de nuestra codera.
No more messages.
To give us your opinions on Sound Opinions, call our hotline, 888-859-1800. We'll be back next week with more Sound Opinions, produced by WBEZ Chicago and distributed by PRX.
Yo squad,